Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In mid-June, just last month, the Shanghai Composite Index was at a huge all-time high. It had soared more than 150% in a year. China's stock markets were roaring. By the middle of last week, the Shanghai Index had plummeted down a full third, $3.2 trillion in value gone. The Chinese government has been all over it, pumping in money, restricting trading, censoring negative media. So what now for China and the world? This hour on Point, China's wild stock market ride and what it means. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Has it hit you? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Washington is Eswar Prasad, professor of trade policy at Cornell University, senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, previously chief of the Financial Studies Division in the International Monetary Fund's Research Department. He was head of the IMF's China Division before that, author of The Dollar Trap. Eswar Prasad, welcome back to On Point. Great to have you.
Always a pleasure being on your show, Tom.
Also with us from Lexington, Massachusetts, is Bill Kirby, professor of China Studies at Harvard University, professor of business administration at Harvard Business School, author of Can China Lead? Reaching the Limits of Power and Growth. Bill Kirby, welcome to On Point.
It's a pleasure to be with you, Tom.
It's great to have you both. I'm just back from a little time away with some kind of crazy cold. I caught it 30,000 feet over Iowa. Something in my chest, so bear with me today. Eswar Prasad, let's jump in first with you. The market had a couple of days of recovery, a down day again today. Is this enormous stock market swoon in China over? Do we have any idea?
Well, Tom, I guess there are two ways to look at it. One, there is some not-so-bad news, and then there is some not-so-good news. Let's start with the not-so-bad news. It's true that the stock market has taken a tumble over the last month or so, but if you look at what's happened over the last year, the stock market is still up a fair bit. And in fact, even if you bought stocks in China at the beginning of this year, you're still up about 15%.
Not too bad.
Not bad at all compared to all the alternatives. If you look at the amount of freely floating shares in China, it's about a third of the economy's size, which is much lower than in most advanced economies. Stocks account for only about 15% of household assets. So yes, the stock market is undergoing wild gyrations, and it has in the past, but the big question is whether this will hurt the economy. And that's where the not-so-good news comes in. I think no matter what is happening to the stock market, which was getting somewhat disconnected from the real economy before it started coming down to earth, I think the two big questions in China are what this implies for the financial markets. It's becoming clear that China does not have the sort of deep and broad and relatively stable financial markets, especially equity markets, that will support the right kind of growth in China, especially in an economy that it's slowing down. And the second aspect is that this signals that the Chinese government may be going somewhat slower in its reforms to make the economy more market-oriented and to make the financial sector more liberalized. And both of those could have potentially serious consequences for China's growth in the future, especially the sort of growth that could be good for China, which is driven less by heavy investment in both physical plant infrastructure and residential construction, which has some bad consequences for the economy, including for the environment. So ideally, they would like an economy that is driven more by household consumption rather than investment or exports. And if the financial system is not working well, if they cannot get the reforms underway, that's going to be very difficult. And that'll mean that China cannot really pull the rest of the world economy along with it. And that's a problem because now China is the biggest, second biggest economy in the world and has been the biggest contributor to world growth since the financial crisis. So if China stumbles, it's going to hurt all of us.
I want to look at the bigger economic picture in China and the implications for the world. Bill Kirby, the Chinese government has been remarkably interventionist in this stock market swoon in China, canceling all IPOs, initial public offerings, creating a fund to buy up all kinds of unwanted shares, effectively pumping money into the market, ordering institutional investors, big shareholders not to sell, suspending trading or permitting that in more than 1,000 firms. Why has Beijing gone to such extreme lengths to try and prop up an already high market?
It's an absolutely great question, Tom. You know, I would agree entirely with Ishwar that in a broad sense, the fundamentals of the Chinese economy are strong. But what this crisis in the last week would indicate to me is that the fundamentals of Chinese government and of governance are not very strong or not as strong as they may seem from a distance. You have a stock market here whose historic purpose in the PRC period has been to promote state enterprise, to force the savings of individuals who have very few other outlets for their savings into a limited number of stocks and into an exchange that historically has been dominated by state-owned enterprises and state banks. It's worked very well. It's one reason to prop up the stock market. It's a way of recapitalizing Chinese state-owned enterprises, which have been, you know, corporatized over the last decades and more, but not to any significant degree privatized. And the surprising thing, I think, to a lot of people in the last week was the sense of panic in the Chinese government, the sense of insecurity. And if you were to look beyond the markets, and you were to look into other realms of politics, into the political front, the purge of the alleged or the apparent enemies of the current leadership, or the rectification, as it is called in Chinese communist rhetoric, of universities and ideology, you have a sense, and a surprising one from a distance, but I think a quite accurate sense of insecurity on the part of the government, but seldom does it let itself show obvious panic. And in this case, you know, now nearly 2 years removed from the promise of very significant economic reforms and market reforms, a more market-oriented economy, it is clear that it is still a largely, at the heights of power, state-driven and party-driven economy, and the leadership acted, I think, significantly overreacted and made a difficult but natural situation of a very much overvalued market, a natural correction, turned it into a major political issue in which your small shareholder today, who may well be better off by 70% than a year ago, but doesn't have the capacity to sell, or your large shareholder today can't sell your stocks because you might be accused of profiteering, we're in a very unnatural economic situation, which reveals a lot about the nature of Chinese governance.
I want to look at what's market-driven and what's not in China. There's a lot of kind of, at some level, almost freakish stuff on display here, at least by American standards. On the other hand, Ishwar Prasad, if you go back to 2007, 2008, we saw some quite major interventions by the U.S. government. We saw bailouts. We saw huge stimulus plans. Then has Beijing's intervention on behalf of the stock markets there been different in kind and scale dramatically from U.S. intervention half a dozen years ago?
What China is doing now is certainly not a new playbook either for China or for other governments. There have been governments around the world, including very market-oriented economies like Hong Kong and Japan right now that are trying to prop up their stock markets. So this is something that other governments have done as well. But I think the context, as Bill has pointed out, is quite different here. The Chinese government has really pinned its survival and legitimacy on delivering in terms of economic gains for its population. President Xi's government has made it abundantly clear that political, institutional, legal reforms are off the table. So what do you do in order to make sure that those pressures don't arise? You have to make sure that the economy works well. And it's in that context, I think, that this government is very concerned about any sign or indication that it is losing control. And that is why we are seeing this very forceful response. Now, of course, when the stock market began its run-up over a year ago, it suited the government quite well because at the time, the economy was slowing down. So the fact that you had the stock market booming presumably had at least a small positive effect on household consumption. And as Bill pointed out, it also made it easier for firms to finance themselves. But I think this panicky reaction comes from the fact that even though the overall spillover effects on the economy may not be large, the fact that just in the first quarter of 2015, you had about 8 million new trading accounts being opened suggests that there is a possibility that these people who got into the stock market very late are going to create some amount of turmoil. And that's something the government wants to avoid. So this desire to show that it is in control, I think, is far more important than what effect the stock market decline could have on the economy, which by itself is not likely to be great. But it does portend something much more important in the political context here.
Bill Kirby, second biggest economy in the world, an enormous economy with tremendous throw weight. We're not accustomed to an economy of that scale being in the hands of a government that that looks so panicky. Is this a problem for the world economy?
Well, as Ishwar points out, this will not have been the first government on Earth to have panicked in the face of an apparent financial crisis. But at the same time, I think you see in this and in other areas signs of rather profound insecurity. But just on the economic front, it's a surprising time in the making of Chinese economic politics that under previous administrations, the premier, in this case Li Keqiang, would be first and foremost in charge of the economy. And he did preside over the promise of a series of reforms several years ago of a greater, much greater role of the market playing the primary force in the Chinese economy. That has simply not happened. And Mr. Xi Jinping's leadership has really a forceful leadership in virtually every area, including the economic. And this intervention, at least to me, would seem to have Mr. Xi's fingerprints upon it.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about China's real economy beyond the wild stock market ride lately. What's really going on? With Ishwar Prasad of Cornell University, Bill Kirby of Harvard, China's market up 150%, the Shanghai Composite Index, year ending early June, let's say. Since then, tumbling by about a third, a very wild ride, massive government intervention. My guests today say signs of panic in Beijing over what's going on in the market there. Here's former Treasury Secretary Larry Summers talking about the fall in the Chinese stock market on CNBC's Squawk Box on Monday. Summers points out that China's stock market, relatively small compared to the Chinese economy, but important in the psychological power, of course, it holds.
I think it is hugely important psychologically as a kind of scoreboard and a kind of reflection on the government's ability to keep control of things.
The ability to keep control of things. And the Chinese government asserting that, or attempting to, on many fronts lately, not just around stock prices. Global implications. Here's Bloomberg on Bloomberg Business on Monday. Ruchir Sharma, head of emerging markets at Morgan Stanley, said he fears China could cause the next global recession.
Historically, for the world, the U.S. economy has what has mattered the most. So every single major global recession in the last 50 years has been caused by the U.S. economy stumbling or going into a recession. My take is that in the next couple of years, the next global recession will be made in China, just like many other things are in the world today.
Next global recession made in China. Ishwar Prasad, I have to say, Wall Street has looked fairly calm in response to this. Why? Do they look and say, well, far away, not our problem, not big enough? What? We haven't really seen. I mean, yes, there was some drop, but we haven't really seen any kind of domino effect off China's, Shanghai's problems.
So I would actually argue that China's growth over the next 2 years is not the big concern. They have enough room in terms of being able to boost the economy through monetary policy measures like interest rate cuts or flooding the economy with more money, or using fiscal policy, increasing government expenditures, for instance, to boost the economy. The big question is how they get the growth that they say they will get, which is around 6.5 to 7% over the next couple of years. Now, in fact, the data that have come in over the last 2 days suggests that the economy is stabilizing somewhat. Retail sales, industrial production, GDP growth are all coming in at a level suggesting that the economy is stabilizing. The housing market is still a problem, but we are beginning to see signs of a bit of a rebound. So the overall picture on China is not quite as gloomy as it was even a few weeks ago. But here is the real risk, Tom. If China starts slowing further, if the stock market decline starts having a psychological effect on consumers and firms, and that brings down growth, then the government could go back to its playbook that it opened up in 2008, 2009, when the financial crisis hit, of opening up the spigots of bank credit, which in turn will finance an investment-fueled economic boom. Now, that is a real problem, both for China and for the rest of the world.
Why?
For China, it's going to create more investment in industries where there is already some excess capacity. And industries that have fueled the investment boom in infrastructure and residential housing. And the problem here is that China does not have a good financial system. This is why the stock market decline is so important if it affects financial market reforms. China saves a lot, about 49% of its GDP, and if that money is not intermediated into good investment, it's going to keep going to state enterprises that don't invest wisely. So you'll have even more excess capacity in industries like steel, cement, aluminum, hard glass. And if China cannot absorb this, what can China do with it? It's going to have to export. So it cannot soak up as much demand from the rest of the world, and it's going to be looking to the rest of the world, and that could end up leading to prices falling around the world. And many countries in the world, advanced economies, are already facing very low inflation or deflation, so this would add to downward pressure on prices. And China would be looking to the rest of the world to import from it, and that's not a good situation for China or for the world economy, because that could lead to a lot of economic instability over the medium term. So what I would say is, let's not look so much at what happens in the next 2 years in terms of growth. I don't think China is going to have a big recession that it's going to export to the rest of the world. But if it doesn't get the right sort of growth in the next 2 years, and if they don't undertake the reforms they plan to undertake, then we could be headed for some big trouble in China and the rest of the world.
Without the right kind of growth, it sounds like a possibility of all kinds of dumping going on there. Part of that psychological, I guess. Chinese investors, here's one talking with CNN on July 7th about his fears about the decline in the Chinese stock market.
No, it's impossible for the market to bounce back anytime soon. This is like the 8-year war against the Japanese. It may take 8 years for the market to turn around.
Historical reference there, back to World War II time for one Chinese investor. Bill Kirby, can we trust the numbers coming out of Beijing? You say there's been a kind of panic there. Just in the last day, they're reporting 7% second quarter growth. In the U.S. or most of the developed world, that would be fantastic. In China, it's the low end, but it's within the range they want to see. But I'm looking, Andrew Polk here, Conference Board economist, says the headline number here is divorced from at least the underlying numbers they've given us, and at worst, divorced from reality. Is China being straightforward in calculating its own growth, Bill?
I think, broadly speaking, the numbers are as accurate as they are for most economies, so the numbers that we receive for most economies. Okay. It includes some investment, to be sure, in what turned out to be useless, overinvestment in producer industries, areas where there's overcapacity. And I agree, entirely with the point that I think that the fundamentals of the economy and its capacity for continued growth are strong, particularly in the private sector. And yet what the government knows how to do is to promote growth through investment in the public sector. This is the great playbook of the Chinese Communist Party. It's fantastic at infrastructure projects. It's very poor at the promotion of entrepreneurship. And if you look at the engines of economic growth long term in places like Korea or Taiwan, there's an important sector that has yet to grow to its capacity in China. That's small and medium-sized enterprises, the kind of which that don't get funding from state-owned banks, which promote primarily state-owned enterprises, which get funding still today the old-fashioned way from family, from friends, from underground banking networks, and so on. And for some of these firms, were they to grow to some size, the capacity to raise additional capital through a well-working capital markets and a well-working stock exchange, that would be a remarkable shift. But this has not been the main effort. The people, if you go, you look at Alibaba, this great private company has done in its incredible innovation of how people can do business with each other across traditional boundaries.
Alibaba, the internet giant, yes.
The internet giant. It has done more to promote interprovincial commerce and trade in the People's Republic of China than any government ministry over the last 10 to 15 years. But the private sector is both prized because it can bring higher levels of economic growth by the Chinese Communist Party. It's prized by the party, and it is feared by the party, which seeks to co-opt it at virtually every turn.
I want to look further into that fear on the government's part for a moment. Let's get a call here first from Nashville, Tennessee. Zach is calling. Zach, you're on the air.
Okay. My question is, as the expert have not talked about the gold reserve effect, gold reserve.
Yes, the gold reserve.
Has,
okay.
And also all the investment they have in buildings, which are too expensive for ordinary people to consume. Maybe they should lower the cost of the cost of accommodating those occupying those houses to the general population. Maybe then they will have more liquidity going on.
Zach, let us pick up both of those. China's gold reserves, Iswar Prasad, and for that matter, it's holdings of all kinds of international currencies. But start with gold. Does this affect it? The money that China's been pumping into the stock market, the government's been pumping in, the situation it finds itself here in, does it affect its gold reserves, its other reserves, for that matter, U.S. Treasury purchasing?
Now, China has a relatively modest amount of gold reserves compared to its overall stock of foreign exchange reserves. Its foreign exchange reserves are in the range of $3.8 trillion. And officially, China holds about 1,050 tons of gold. So at current market prices, even if you think they hold twice that in reality, that's still going to be barely $100 billion or so. So the Chinese government is not really lacking for cash to prop up the stock market or to prop up the economy. The real question here is whether it's going to be able to push through its market-oriented reforms. Now, is China going to be buying fewer U.S. treasuries? China is intervening less in the foreign exchange market to prop up its currency because right now, because China has been opening up the capital account, meaning making it easier to take money both into and out of China, some money has been going out of China, and for good reasons, really, because I think it's good for Chinese households and corporations not to concentrate their investments just domestically. They're investing abroad. So all of that means that there is no longer pressure on the Chinese renminbi to appreciate, which means that the Chinese government is no longer intervening in foreign exchange markets and building up reserves. So they're not buying more U.S. treasuries. They're not buying any other assets right now. So I think that's a relatively small piece of the bigger question. And I think the big question really is, again, what this means for the reform process, which is going to be crucial for China.
Iswar, what about Chinese stockholders? What portion of Chinese even own stock? Is it comparable to the American profile or something different?
Now, the numbers that we have suggest that about 15% of overall household assets are held in stock. So that, I think, suggests that this is not going to have a huge effect. The problem is that you have lots of very small retail investors. As I mentioned, estimates said there are about 8 million trading accounts that were opened in the first quarter of 2015. Those are the people who got into the party very late, and they're getting burned. And the fact that you have lots of these small investors plunking down their life savings at exactly the wrong time, I think, is going to hurt. Now, the previous caller also talked about the investment boom, and I think that's the really big concern for China. Lots of money still going into the housing market, into investment. On the housing market, which until a few weeks ago was the big concern about China before the stock market started taking a tumble, things have actually stabilized. Prices have begun to come back up a bit, especially in the first and second tier cities. But China, as with everything else, is a paradox. On the one hand, there is too much housing supply. On the other hand, there isn't enough supply of good, affordable housing for the middle class. So how China handles these paradoxes remains to be seen.
Bill, where do you think the Chinese government's unease is coming from exactly here? You pointed out they've been intervening enormously in the stock market. They've been cracking down elsewhere. I mean, just in the last few days, we saw reports of human rights attorneys in China apparently being rounded up or under house arrest. I mean, there are few enough of them. You wouldn't think it'd even be a problem for the Chinese government. They're so marginal, and yet even there, this government cracking down. Xi Jinping presents this image of strength as China's top leader now. Is that somehow alongside a fear or a fact of weakness?
Yeah, I think it's a combination. It is a government of enormous strength and capacity and a government of enormous insecurity. If you were to think of the stock exchange, so China has about 90 million retail investors, which is a good bit more than the number of Chinese Communist Party members, about which is in the upper 80s. Now, mind you, some of those party members may also be retail investors as well. But it's a large number of people, even if it's a small part of the economy. Mm-hmm. And they're putting their savings. You know, if you're a person with savings in China, you can put it into a bank and you'll get virtually nothing from doing it. You could put it into property, and people have done that. And it has done well in time, but today it's pretty much steady state, a little bit bouncing back, as Sichuan noted. Or you can put it into stocks, which is a government-controlled lottery, more than it is a professional stock exchange. But if you look at the broader areas of insecurity, again, from a distance, this looks to be the strongest, most powerful, most capable government on Earth, able to do infrastructure projects the likes of which no one else on Earth can do. And yet there's a profound insecurity if you see the arrest of 50 human rights lawyers most recently, or if you see what you might call a two-faced policy toward what it means to be a global leader. China has invested enormous amounts of money and energy into building up world-class universities, Beijing University, Tsinghua University. These are extraordinary places with some of the best faculty and students in the world, and they will be among the world's leaders. And yet over the last 6 months, there's been a strong ideological campaign in these universities to reassert core communist values, to study the speeches of President Xi Jinping, almost a neo-Maoist approach to higher education. Not that bad, to be sure, but an enormous sense of insecurity of what the next generation of Chinese leaders are likely to think. And that tells me that the Chinese Communist Party, we have a government here, in my view, Mr. Xi Jinping, the primary mission of which is, of course, to do well for China, but the primary mission is to preserve the rule of the Chinese Communist Party. And the fact of the matter is, whether it's in stock markets or in education or in other areas, the interests of China as a country and that of its ruling party are not perfectly coterminous.
Ishwar, there's been a lot of talk about the Chinese model in recent years as the, you know, some of the European and American economies were really in trouble. Are we seeing contradictions exposed here that may take some of the shine off that model?
Now, this was the interesting thing, Tom. I must confess that at this stage, having studied China for a while, I don't understand fully how China has managed this very delicate balancing act of creating a lot of risks with its growth model, but somehow also generating enough resources to get over its risks. But that's a big question now, whether China can actually manage to grow despite all the risks its growth model has created. Those tensions are coming to a head now.
Hi, everybody. Tom here. I'm glad you're joining us for this On Point podcast. Before we get back to the show, I'd like to tell you about another podcast you might enjoy, too, Dear Sugar Radio.
Join hosts Cheryl Strayed and Steve Almond as they field questions about love, sex, work, guilt, money, you name it. That's Dear Sugar Radio. You can find it at wbur.org/Dear Sugar or subscribe on iTunes. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about China's real economy beyond the wild stock market ride lately. What's really going on there and its implications for the rest of the world. Bill Kirby is with us from Harvard and the Harvard Business School, author of Can China Lead? Reaching the Limits of Power and Growth. Ishwar Prasad is with us, professor of trade policy at Cornell University, been at IMF watching China before that, author of The Dollar Trap. The Chinese premier, who, as Bill said, has traditionally, the premier in China, has traditionally held the tiller on the economy, speaking in Paris on July 1st at the OECD meeting there about his hopes for the Chinese economy. Long way to go here, he said, in spite of the fact that China's become so big, many Chinese still living below the world's sort of average level of prosperity. Here he is, interpreted by CCTV.
In terms of aggregate economy, it is true that China ranks as the world's second, but in terms of per capita GDP, China's per capita GDP is only $7,589, 65% of the world's average level. Our goal is that by the middle of the century, China will enter the world of the mid-developed countries.
Ambitions still very large there to move from what's still per capita pretty modest average income there. Listeners responding online here, Wynn says it's good to see China trying to save the people from losing their shirts. Of course, that would never happen in America, the land of too-big-to-fail capitalism. Hope China succeeds. Jim writes, though, due to looking at inequality in China, he says, he's saddened to see Chinese duped by the government into investing in that stock market, better known as the second casino of China after Macau. Jim writes, what the government did to prop up the equity markets is going to be temporary. The bear market will continue. It'll be even worse. I hope these small Main Street investors in China sell before it's too late. But a lot of them, we're reading here, Ishwar, cannot sell. What is the liquidity? How do they stop people from selling when they want to sell?
Well, what they've been doing is essentially stopping the big institutional investors, the state-owned enterprises, from selling. They've also started actually buying shares by directly intervening in the stock market through a stock fund that is funded by the central bank, the People's Bank of China. They've also banned IPOs, that is initial public offerings, mm-hmm. by new firms, so that reduces the supply of shares. So all of these are interventionist measures to try to cool things down. Now, here again, there is a funny sort of tension that the Chinese government is facing, because my view is that they recognize that they need to deliver the economic goods, so to speak, and they need a lot of reforms. So they're trying to introduce some notion of market discipline in an economy that is not used to it. So in this case, we did see stock prices coming down a mm-hmm. significant extent before they intervened. So what they're trying to do is introduce some degree of market discipline, but at the same time, the difficulty they face is that they don't want to show loss of control. So what they should have done with the stock market is really try to bite it before it started getting so much out of hand, because at the time they were initially almost encouraging it both by word and by action, and that's come back to bite them right now. So my view is actually that their heart is in the right place in terms of reform, but by reform, what they mean is something very different from what we might see. They want to move towards a more market-oriented economy, but still one where the government pulls the strings behind the scenes and has a significant degree of control.
You have to wonder how far that can go. It's a very subtle business. Ishwar Prasad saying after all his years studying China, still not quite clear how it works. Jim in Saratoga, New York. Jim, thanks for calling. You're on.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm just calling to relay experience my son is having currently in China. He's been working there for 3 years. He's a teacher.
Where, Jim?
In southern China, Guangzhou.
Sure.
And he pays off his student loans through a company here in the United States. He's always done so each month by
okay.
going online
mm-hmm.
and entering his password, and they would deduct the money from his bank account and pay
yep.
off the loan. Suddenly, 2 months ago, they blocked his access to that account.
In China, I guess.
Yeah, I guess China has blocked it, so huh. he has to email me when the time comes,
right.
I in turn call the bank or go online to the bank here in the United States and have them make the deduction for his student loan payment. I'm just wondering, are they just trying to crack down on all foreign bank access, even to small potato individuals like my son?
That is really interesting. Bill Ishwar, thoughts there? I mean, we've heard about a lot of Chinese money coming out, as you've said, a lot of real estate purchases in the United States and elsewhere by Chinese. Is it possible that Jim's young son trying to make his college payments is running into a kind of Chinese firewall here?
You know, it could well be, Tom, that Jim's son, he's simply caught in a one-size-fits-all effort of controlling outflows and also of controlling internet business. My guess is that this is these are efforts that are not aimed at his son, but at others. And yet it shows you one of the great frustrations that private business people have or that private citizens have in China, because, you know, again, one of the symbols of the insecurity of the Chinese government is this great firewall of China, which has become tighter and tighter over the last several years, and in which denies Chinese, even with access, use of some of the best search engines in the world, some of the ways in which much of the rest of the world has the capacity to do business. And it is a
You're breaking up on us there, Bill, but it is amazing to contemplate the kind of pressure and tensions as China tries to simultaneously keep Communist Party control and have the energy of a market economy working for it. This is a drama we're going to be watching, it sounds to me, for some time here. Sharon in Nashville, you're on the air, Sharon. Thank you for calling.
Thanks a lot. I think the International Money Fund is going to meet this fall. And there's some talk of inviting the yuan, the currency of China, to be a world currency. And I wondered what your guests think of that and if, in fact, they think it's true and what the implications are for the United States.
Yes, thank you very much, Sharon. Ishwar, the Chinese currency and where it heads in the midst of all this, implications of the U.S.
That's an interesting issue. I think what the caller is referring to is that the International Monetary Fund, the IMF, has what is called the special drawing rights. It's a basket of four currencies that create this composite currency unit that the IMF uses in all its accounting. So it's not a currency that you can take to the grocery store, but it has some implications in international finance because there are just four major currencies, the Japanese yen, the euro, the U.S. dollar, and the British pound sterling, that are part of this SDR basket. And the Chinese have indicated they want the renminbi to be part of the basket later this year. And I suspect the IMF will accede. But the question is whether China really meets the qualifications that are necessary, because China needs to have no restrictions on capital outflows. Its currency should be market determined. It should have a well-developed financial system so that foreign investors can buy high-quality Chinese assets. So China doesn't meet any of these criteria. But, of course, it is the second-largest economy in the world. It's growing very fast. The currency is becoming used more broadly. So the question is whether the IMF's official seal of approval, in some sense, will be a game-changer. Interestingly, I think it will be a game-changer, but in a very different dimension. I don't think the renminbi is in any way going to challenge the U.S. dollar, because China does not have the trust of foreign investors. It does not have deep financial markets. But what the Chinese government has been doing is saying that this is an important signpost for our economy, because after all, we're a big economy. We should have a currency that matches our prestige on the world stage. And to do that, we need to do certain things domestically. We need better financial markets. We need a better financial regulatory architecture. So they're using this as a way of generating momentum for domestic reform. So the Chinese government is very committed to this. I think they will get there. But the big question is whether they can use it as an effective tool to break down resistance to domestic reforms. And that's where, again, the stock market decline becomes very unfortunate, because all the commitments they've made to free up their financial system could get rolled back to some extent by what they're doing right now.
Julia in Springfield, Ohio. Thank you for calling, Julia. You're on.
Hi. I just thought it might be important to address China's complete neglect of the environment and to ask if, as they try to become more of a central and typical economic participant, if there is some move toward improving their environmental record, and as investors move toward China, if that shouldn't be considered.
Julie, I appreciate your call. Bill, how about it? First of all, the broad characterization. We've seen those soupy skies over Beijing and elsewhere, seen the rivers turn strange colors and floods of dead pigs coming down the river. Is China still an environmental nightmare? We also see these headlines about them making major commitments to solar energy and so on. And with this downturn in the stock market, would that tempt them to diminish whatever environmental reform efforts they're in the midst of?
So I'm broadly optimistic coming out of what has been this horrific period of Chinese environmental degradation. Now, China's environment has suffered 1,000 years of environmental degradation, not just over the last 30 or so years, but it has been terrible since then. Last October, I was in Beijing at one of the worst days of pollution and one of the worst weeks, because factories all around Beijing were going 24/7, knowing that they would be shut down for the APEC meeting of global leaders in early November.
So it wouldn't be so grotesque, the air pollution during that meeting.
So it shows you what the command economy can do. 300 million people suffer bad air for 3 weeks so that 30 people can pretend to have good air for 3 days.
Wow.
But I, you know, this is a government of, among other things, of engineers. This is a government, the command economy part of which, with the political will, which it is beginning to have, can probably do a great deal in the area of the reduction of pollution over time. Certainly for its legitimacy and its longevity, it will need to do so. And where I am optimistic about China, or at least parts of China, one part at a time perhaps.
Okay.
I was a student 30-something years ago in Taiwan, when it was one of the most polluted places on Earth. I was there just last week, and it is a beautiful and green and, by comparative standards, pristine place because of the combination of political forces working, opposition party also, working strongly for a cleaner and greener Taiwan. I think this will happen in time in different parts of China.
Let's go to West Palm Beach, Florida, and Simon. Simon, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. One of your panelists just said the conventional wisdom that the Chinese government helps the Chinese people, but of course its number one priority is to shore up the Communist Party. How can he be sure it's not the other way around? In other words, how can he be sure that it's not that they actually, number one priority is to help out the Chinese people, and they believe, rightly or wrongly, that shoring up the Communist Party and making sure that the principles that they've applied to the economy continue to be applied is the best way of doing that? Is it not simply ideological to claim that they want the party to survive first and help the people second? And I don't see how on earth you can make the statement to indeed differentiate between those two.
Interesting question and exercise to turn it around. Iswar, how do you take that on board?
Now, the political leadership, of course, like politicians anywhere in the world, does care about its survival. And I don't think there is anything inconsistent between the two, because helping the people and have better lives is the way for the party to perpetuate itself as well. So I think this is what any government in any country would try to do. The question is whether this is just a benevolent government that is looking out for the interests of its people, or if it's doing other things that may not necessarily be giving its people a better life. And it gets into a philosophical discussion about whether it's just not economics, but also freedom of expression, the ability to engage in political activities that may go against the party. And in all of those dimensions, again, President Xi Jinping has made it abundantly clear that there are going to be no other freedoms like freedom of the press, freedom to associate freely, freedom to express one's views. And the question becomes whether those ideals are consistent with the way the Communist Party is now structured. And I think the answer to that is fairly clearly no. So the economic imperative, I think, trumps those other imperatives, and that's what the government seems to be really focused on.
Bill, yeah. Do you see American industry being hit if the economy takes further hit there, or has to turn back to its export drive again in order to regain some more robustness? We've seen big American automobile sales in China lately, just for one. Does that go on? Do we get a direct hit or indirect of some kind here?
Well, let me, I think, again, the fundamentals, broad fundamentals of the Chinese economy are strong. And that they will, and those businesses that have been successful in China, American and other international businesses, will continue to be successful. You will see significant new Chinese investments in this country by private as well as state-owned enterprises, but increasingly by private enterprises that can make a good and positive difference for the American economy. But let me just comment on the last caller's question. And Ishwar's, I think, quite excellent response.
20 seconds, Bill. 20 seconds.
Yeah. So rural economy needs people to have health insurance and education in order to grow and have a new generation of consumers. But what farmers really need, and which they will never get from this government, is the property rights to own the land that their families have tilled for generations. A rich country cannot have, as China has, poor farmers.
We will see over time. They've had it for a long, long time. They're riding a little bit of a whirlwind right now. Simon in West Palm Beach and everybody else, we will watch and see who gains what. Lately, a whole lot of losses, but still strength beneath. I want to thank our guests, Ishwar Prasad, Bill Kirby. Thank you very much for being with us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.